Everyone, please rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. Please be seated. Morning.
Good morning.
We have three cases scheduled for argument this morning. We understand counsel in all of those cases have announced ready. So we'll call the first case on this morning's docket, Emily Farlow versus Harris Methodist Fort Worth Hospital.
May it please the court, Mr. John Newton will argue for appellants, and Mr. David Peltner will argue for appellees.
May it please the court, Justice Casey and Justices Livingston and Gardner. You know, I feel like Dallas-Fort Worth is one congruous city-state of sorts until you come over to Fort Worth and you have David Keltner to argue against in an appellate argument. You feel like this is not your hometown. But actually, David's a very good friend of mine from law school, and he's a terrific lawyer. If I'd like to explain what I'd like to do because of the time limitations. I don't plan to address the evidentiary issues of which we complain. We are not waiving those, but we certainly would like you to refer to the brief on those as well as the ostensible authority claims. The other three, which is managerial capacity, respondeat superior, and ratification, we would like to commence argument on. Harris Methodist runs an emergency room in downtown Dallas, as I'm sure you're aware. They need doctors and they need nurses and they need, of course, surgeons to do the work, which their work, of course, is caring for patients. Rather than be honest about it, Harris Methodist creates this legal fiction, and that is new recruits like John Fewins, the physician at issue here, are not under their control, that they are independent practitioners. Respectfully, Harris has a problem with that. They have a recruitment agreement, and the recruitment agreement is very specific about the elements of control and the indicia of control, which are pronounced. They had John Fewins sign a recruitment agreement because they wanted to, I'm sure it was expensive to recruit him. They want him to be there for at least 4 years, which the agreement sets forth. It also sets forth the true agreement, in addition to the legal fiction, which is that he's an independent practitioner. That document in and of itself establishes the extraordinary control, but there's more. It kind of sounds like an infomercial, but there is more. And the more is the actual control that they exhibited over Dr. Fewins. Respectfully, Harris wants to have it both ways. They want to lock in their new physicians with strong controls over them, and we'll go through those, and then take the legal position that they're independent contractors.
Counsel, in your brief, you've identified some indicia of controls, such as taking calls, providing tools, supplies, and materials, agreeing to be available on certain days in the emergency room, and so forth. Are those the only items of control that you're contending that exist here?
No, you're not. No, they're not, Your Honor. There's actual indicia of control that are different than that. And if I could, I think it's helpful to look at the issue of control in light of the case, the seminal case that really describes the importance of control, because control is the issue. I think you focused on it. And that is the limestone factors, and that's what they're called. It's a 2002 Texas Supreme Court case, and those factors are used to analyze the issue of control. There's five factors, and if I may, I'd like to go through each one. The independent nature of the worker's business. If the worker's business is similar to that of Harris, it's more likely that employee-employer relationship exists, and it certainly is in this case. It's the care of patients and provide surgical procedures. The recruitment agreement required that Dr. Fewins take calls at the ER, that he used nurses. And this is not set forth in the agreement, but he used nurses in the emergency room, both a nest and as well used a couple independent contractors, a nurse anesthetist as well as an anesthesiologist himself. They certainly used the tools, supplies, and equipment of Harris. All that was provided by Harris in the operating room. They told him when not only was he obligated, or was he not, and that is actually the second factor in limestone, was the worker obligated to furnish the necessary tools, supplies, and materials? If the worker was not obligated to provide those, then that's another indicia of employment. And in this case, as I said, all of those were provided by Harris Methodist.
But wouldn't that be just like any other operating physician at any hospital who had staff privileges at that particular hospital? I mean, how would this be a different relationship?
Your Honor, it's a good point, but it's different in this regard. It's a combination of actual control plus, in addition to that, the recruiting agreement direct controls over him. And I think when you look at them as a whole, we would urge that it be necessary to submit that to a jury, that it's more than just looking at the agreement. You look at the actual controls in combination with what's in the agreement. And I can't imagine controlling someone more other than moving the scalpel, and that's the case that Mr. Keltner cites. But that's not number one. It's distinguishable for a couple of different reasons, and I'll go through this, if I may, in a moment.
You're talking about the St. Joseph Hospital case?
Yes, sir. That's exactly
distinguishable?
It. Yes, sir, I think
now,
it is.
I was wondering how you would reconcile the test that the Supreme Court applied in that case with the test that you're contending that we should apply in this case under limestone. It seems to me that they're two totally different tests for different situations.
I agree with you, Your Honor. They are different situations.
One is
they
a medical malpractice situation. The other is something else. Shouldn't we follow the St. Joseph case for that reason?
I would urge not, Your Honor, for this reason. It's a borrowed servant case. And there is a different criteria related to borrow servants as opposed to, in our case, that the indicia of control is uniform, I would urge, not only in malpractice cases, but whether someone, as in the limestone case, they're a driver for a cement company. Control is the issue with regard to whether or not someone is your employee. And I would urge that just because someone's a doctor, there's no statutory provision, there's really no case distinction saying, and there's nothing in limestone or cases that address limestone that say, however we carve away doctors and physicians, we have a separate criteria for them. In fact, it's interesting that in arguing the St. Joseph case, when you have a case that's more on point, which is the Dalhite-Nauta case we've cited in our brief, that case, it makes it very clear that controlling the physician doesn't mean that the hospital would be moving the scalpel. Obviously, that's going to be done by the physician. If that were the case, as that decision says, then you'd never have a physician be an employee of a hospital. It just wouldn't occur because the physician is always going to take the initiative, is always going to do those sorts of things. However, if you look at all of the surrounding circumstances of control other than moving the scalpel, by the way, if the court finds that moving the scalpel is the criteria, then we're probably not going to be successful because there's no question of fact about that. That, in fact, we don't contest the fact that in terms of performing the operation, the malpractice itself, that was done by Dr. Fewens.
What about a situation where a senior physician, so to speak, employed by the hospital, supervising a junior physician? Wouldn't that make that junior physician in that hypothetical possibly an employee of the hospital or being under the direct control of the...
I agree, and in fact, that's the case in ours, that according to the bylaws, which he is contractually bound to follow, according to the bylaws in our case, for the first series of operations of procedures performed, and in the first 12 months, he is to be proctored for those series of procedures. And proctored, and it doesn't describe what proctor means, but I would think that they followed their bylaws in this case. They certainly had some proceeding relating to his performance of this surgery and a review of it by the hospital, and I think that's another indicia of control that we can refer to that makes this case different than the case that Mr. Keltner cites. The third factor in limestone in terms of determining control is the worker's right to control the progress of the work except about the final results. They control the progress of his work in that for several different reasons. You referred to a few, Justice Casey, but they also, he was contractually obligated to serve every third night in the emergency room. He was obligated within a certain period of time, 30 minutes, to respond to that call. They determined where the procedure was going to take place, which operating room of their several operating rooms. They have a suite of operating rooms. They decided which one. They decided, as I said, the nurses. They decided the nurse anesthetists and the anesthesiologists. By the way, the nurses themselves, the two nurses, scrub nurse and the other nurse, were both employees of the hospital. They made all those decisions. They also decided the when the operation was going to occur. Dr. Fewins wanted to have the operation on Friday and asked that it be accomplished then. They decided that it would be, the hospital decided it would be Saturday morning, and they decided which, as I said, which operating room. So those are certainly factors of control. They also require that Harris required Dr. Fewins to work 35 hours a week, 48 weeks a year. That is certainly control. Harris, in addition, they had they required him to personally care for Harris patients at Harris Hospital. Harris required Dr. Fewins to not refer patients to practitioners with no staff privileges. In other words, if he sees someone on call, the way it worked often was he'd see someone on call, they would want him to perform the procedure. He'd recommend a procedure, say that it's appropriate to be done, as in our case. For example, he came in with a splitting headache. He didn't know, Mr. Farlow didn't know what the problem was. He came in, he saw an emergency room physician. He then saw who referred him to the on-call ENT surgeon, Dr. Fewins, and Dr. Fewins saw him and recommended this procedure. And the procedure was supposed to be fairly simple. It was supposed to be just going into a sinus, draining it because of the congestion, and biopsying to make sure there was nothing wrong inside. As it turns out, he biopsied the brain in a couple different instances, and which led to the devastating injury that we have in this case. From the moment that Dr. Farlow was wheeled into the emergency room, we would urge that Harris control the when, where, by whom, and with whom his treatment was going to be undertaken. I would add another fact of control, and that was Harris required Dr. Fewins to join any health maintenance or preferred provider organization that the hospital wanted him to join. So I think control is there, and respectfully I would urge in spades. The time for which the employer is employed, generally a short time period, favors, according to the limestone factors, a short time period favors the independent contractor status. In this case, we have a four-year contract. A four-year contract, the first year of which he was guaranteed a salary. It was guaranteed $31,667 each month. To the extent he didn't meet that criteria, maybe he just brought in on his own $10,000 worth of business, they would pay him the difference every month within a certain period of time after the first of the month, within a few days.
That amount contemplate his private practice?
It did contemplate his private practice. He didn't have to exclusively work at the hospital, although that was the majority of his work that he got. But he couldn't, and that's a good point, Justice Gardner, he could not go to another hospital and have similar sorts of privileges, similar sorts of arrangements for recruiting agreements that would involve periods of time he would have to be on call at the hospital.
But am I correct that he did have staff privileges at other hospitals?
He did, yes. The fifth limestone factor is the method of payment, whether by unit or time or by the job. And in this case, I've told you what the paying arrangement is. He received a signing bonus. And by the way, to be fair, it actually amounts to a loan of sorts because he's entitled when the period of time is over to repay it at a certain very favorable interest rate. He received the signing bonus for agreeing to the 4 years of serving at the hospital. And I would urge that In the instance of if they get paid for a job-by-job basis, that's what would indicate an independent contractor. That's what Limestone says. However, in this case, it's not that. It's he gets paid generally for seeing patients and not one individual patient. Harris suggests, as you've pointed out, that as in the St. Joseph v. Wolf case, that it must exercise medical judgment in order for Farlow to prove the requirement. I would urge, and we would urge, the Wolf case, excuse me, the Mark v. Shield case. That's a 03 Texas Supreme Court case. We think that that is useful in this, and I'll quote on page 867 of 120 Southwestern 3rd, quote, while the nature of his practice as a physician required him to make many medical decisions using his own professional judgment, necessity for that judgment does not, by itself, vitiate the right to control the details of the practice. And I think that goes to our point here. The quote, of course, in the Dalhite v. Nala case is more specific. How in the world would you have a physician be a, and I'm quoting this, I'm not quoting this, this is my own interpretation, but how in the world would you have a physician be an employee if the hospital was required to perform and tell him how to perform the procedure?
Counsel, your time's up.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court. John and I have an agreement on several things, and that is what the standard is, that you, when we review the idea of control to determine whether somebody is an agent or an employee. And that is Newspapers versus Love, which says that if there's a contract involved, you look at the contract first, unless the actual practice is so pervasive that control was actually exercised and the party over whose control was exercised acquiesced to such an extent that the entire agreement was deemed to have been rewritten. It's a question of law. If you're looking at the agreement itself, it is a question of law, not a question of fact. Only in Newspapers do you get to a question of fact is if you have the issue of whether the contract itself is a fraud and a sham. And that's what Wolf says as well. We in the oral argument handout have pointed out the retention agreement or the recruiting agreement that John has referenced. We have a chart up front with all the things that they have mentioned in their reply brief and gone through what the recruitment agreement does. Here's the truth of the matter, and I'm going to there can't be any disagreement about it because the agreement says what it says. The real issue is that what happened is John Fewins was recruited to Fort Worth, not to Harris Hospital. And in fact, at page 14 of our brief, we go into detail about that when he is questioned by the other side. He did agree to serve on the staff of Harris if he could get privileges, but he was free to serve on other staffs. And Justice Gardner, in answer to your question, I think John was asking something you didn't ask, but what really the truth was, he was on four other staffs. He served the emergency rooms of four other hospitals.
What does that have to do with whether he was under the control of Harris Hospital at the time of the incident?
Your Honor, nothing except that is the fact they argue that demonstrates control, that he was on our staff alone and that, in fact, he was obligated to Harris under the recruiting agreement. I agree with you that it has nothing to do with at the issue at the time. But if it is a contract issue, as he argues, then you have to look at the contract. And the evidence is pretty clear on this. In fact, not only is it clear, it's undisputed, he was on four other hospital staff.
But would you look at the contract to the exclusion I'm speaking in the hypothetical, to the exclusion of evidence showing that, to use Mr. Bickel's words, that the hospital effectively, you know, was directing the scalpel and, I mean, you don't do that. You don't simply ignore that type of control evidence and look to the contract.
Oh, of course not, Your Honor. That's exactly right. If you're going to the idea that the contract is a sham, and in fact there was actual control, you look at those factors. I think under either one of those theories, we win. What I disagree with Mr. Bickel about is I think he applies the wrong standard. I don't think it's Limestone. I think it's Wolf. And I think I can, I'll demonstrate to you why I believe that's the case. First off, Wolf was decided in the same year as Limestone. Limestone was decided 9 months before. It lists the factors that Mr. Bickle listed. There's no doubt about that. But 9 months later, when Wolf was decided by the Texas Supreme Court, they didn't apply the Limestone standards. They don't even cite Limestone in the opinion. And what they say is, look, there is a different standard. They don't say different standard, but they say, here is the standard for doctors and physicians. Now, the interesting thing is, Mr. Bickle says, well, that doesn't count because it's a borrowed servant case. That's not true. If you'll look at the opinion, actually, you'll see that the truth of the matter is the discussion of his employment is under a headnote or a footnote, I mean, in the opinion that says employment and control. So it's clearly that. The other thing is borrowed servant and employment are opposite sides of the same coin. They just, those issues were raised in that case, but employment was crucial. Six times in the opinion, from page 541 through 544, the court says what you had to exercise control over. And I'll let me quote several of them. First is, the thing controlled has to cause the harm. That's page 541. Then when they get into the application of the standard, they say, right to control the details of Filofani's, who was the doctor involved, medical treatment of Wolf. And then what do you control? The details of patient care. That's at page 542. Now, Mr. Bickle mentions the Merck case, which comes out later in 2003.
Counsel, can I interrupt you for a second before you get there? I want to ask you the same question that I'd ask Mr. Bickle, and that is, how would you distinguish these two cases or reconcile these two cases? It's interesting that in St. Joseph, I mean, it is a general discussion, I think, of vicarious liability, employer-employee situation, but what do we do with Limestone if we were to say St. Joseph applies here? What do we say about the Limestone factors?
I think you'd say two things, Your Honor. First off, it is not as applicable to the specific facts in a medical context, and that's what the court was doing in Wolf, and that was...
But in Wolf or St. Joseph, they're talking about factors that would apply across the board to any number of situations.
Well, in Wolf, what the court says is it is an issue if it's... First off, it looks at the contract. Remember, in Limestone, there was no contract. In fact, Limestone can't apply to a case in which there is a contract. In subsequent courts, cases and courts, if we have said in our brief, don't apply the Limestone factors to an instance where there is a contract. And that's important here because Wolf concentrates on the contract up front and then talks about what actually happened as well. But it concentrates, obviously, on the contract, and I think that's another distinction. Mr. Bickle brought up the Merck case.
Is there something more than that?
There's more, too, and I here's what I think it is.
Is it possible the Supreme Court just... You know, right hand, left hand kind of thing. I mean,
I don't know. Hope not. And I don't think we ought to say that out loud, but
no.
It's a fair
well,
question.
Well, you shouldn't say that out loud. I guess I
no, it's a very fair question. There's no doubt that they weren't. I looked at the briefing in this case. Bill Whitehurst was the plaintiff's lawyer who tried the case. He cited Limestone in his briefing to the Supreme Court. Now, actually, the issue was it was in later briefing because the case wasn't initially, did not go up on the issue of employment or borrowed servant. It went up on joint venture, and that's where he had gotten the jury verdict. If you'll notice what the court does is the court drops back and says, we're going to render the case and go ahead and eliminate the other theories if we can, or if not, remand it. And that's where it gets to discussion of borrowed servant and employment. But I think that when you look at the instances that were applied in Limestone to a truck driver in a situation, and by the way, he was found to be an independent contractor as well, for a whole host of reasons of exercising independent control over everything except the pickup of product and the delivery. That's the only thing he was ever told to do, to pick it up and then deliver it. And so I think the result under either would be the same, but I think you look at the contract up front, then you look at what the practice is. And in medical practice, it's different, and this court shows it. For example, John suggests to you that, well, he was required to be in the emergency room at certain times. All doctors at all hospitals under the age of 60 years old, and there's testimony of this in the record, are required to take a rotation in the emergency room and split that with other people who are in their same specialty. This is no different than you would normally do. If John's theory is right, every doctor is an agent or employee of every hospital at which they have staff privileges. He also says, well, you had to use the people there at the hospital. True, you had to use physicians that held staff privileges, and you had to have the nurses at that hospital actually certified. Candidly, that's a governmental requirement. But there are a number of other things like that to go. But he raised one other issue, and that is the Merck case and Dalhite. And he says the Supreme Court actually goes back on what they say about Wolf and Merck, and in Dalhite reaches the opposite conclusion, that you don't look to the details of medical practice. I disagree with John on this reason. It's very clear that when you're looking at Dalhite and Merck, you are looking at cases that interpret the Texas Sovereign Immunity Statute, the Tort Claims Act. And what that statute says is someone in the paid service of government gets statutory immunity unless they're an independent contractor, an employee of an independent contractor, or the government, as a matter of law, can't control their functions and what they do. And so the argument in Dalhite was that a physician that worked at UT Galveston could not was not under sovereign immunity, even though he got W-2s, he was a government employee, he had an employment contract that set the terms, could not determine what patients he saw, and his practice was regulated. The plaintiff's argument was, nope, the details of his practice are such they can't control the details of patient care, therefore he is not, he's an employee, and that's what he is and has to be. And what Judge Brister said, writing in that case, is, no, that proves too much. But what does he do? He interprets the statute, and he goes outside that and poses a hypothetical. A driver driving a car exercises independent judgment that is a matter of statute the government can't control. Nonetheless, the statute covers that. Merck's the same way. What happens in Merck is the court looks at three things. Again, just like in Dalhite, just like in Wolf, they look at the contract first and say, no, he gets a W-2, you get paid benefits, he doesn't control who he sees, and by the way, his practice is controlled by senior faculty members, and in fact, they can regulate what he does, how he does it, and they can even veto his medical decisions. That's the distinction in Merck. And then the other thing they say is, if it weren't that way under the sovereign immunity statute, we'd have a problem, especially for judges. Because judges are exercising independent thought processes that we, the government, can't control, and then they would not be entitled to sovereign immunity as well. Same is true with legislators. It is a statutory construction issue that defines things differently than the common law does on control.
Is there any evidence in this case that the Farlows were informed or advised by hospital employees that they had a right to select another physician to perform this procedure?
Your Honor, there's no evidence of that one way or the other.
You think that would make a difference in this case, the fact that you go to the emergency room, you know, a doctor's assigned to your case, you assume, rightly or wrongly, that you have no choice in the matter, and that this is a hospital-provided physician? And
no, I don't. That would be an ostensible agency question, and the law is very clear on that. It has to be an affirmative holding out before you have the obligation to disabuse, and you'll notice in our brief we discussed that. But in fairness, there was no discussion, a direct discussion of that, except on entry into the hospital. And by the way, these people have been to the hospital previous times, not incapacitated as they claim Lee Farlow was when he came in, and signed the same form in which the patient is advised that the physicians that work for the hospital aren't the employees of the hospital and are independent contractors with independent practices. And in fact, that's true. The real truth of the matter is Dr. Fewins never collected anything from the hospital, wasn't paid by the hospital. He didn't bill through the hospital at all. In the few minutes we have left, I want to talk about things that Mr. Bickle didn't get to in opening argument but says he's going to argue, and that is ratification and managerial capacity. Let me start with ratification. This court has looked at ratification recently in the Miller versus Kennedy and Minshaw case. The truth of the matter is the things they claim are ratification as a matter of law cannot be. For example, they said, well, you didn't fire Dr. Fuens, and you retained him on your staff. Well, in Wolf, the Texas Supreme Court looked at that and said retention and actually giving that doctor a bonus was no evidence and not an element of ratification. Additionally, they say a couple of other things. They say, well, you kept the benefits hospital, you kept the benefits of the surgery. Well, that's not true. What happened is we did send a bill for our part of the surgery with the nurses and all types of other things, never for Dr. Fuens, could not, would not do that. And in any event, they claim that's it. Well, the law is pretty clear on that, and we cited to you to the Thermo Products case. If you have an independent right to take the benefit, it isn't ratification. And actually, I think that is consistent with all the cases in Texas on ratification at all. They mention managerial capacity. They don't cite you a case on managerial capacity that says that that alone is going to make somebody an employee. Instead, they cite a case to you that simply says that somebody who serves in a managerial capacity can be liable. But impunitive damages. And in fact, the real problem they have here is their pleadings on ratification and their pleadings on managerial capacity don't go to a vicarious liability theory at all. And they amended twice after the trial started. Second and third amended petitions don't go at all to that. The only stuff that was pled for was on gross negligence and exemplary damages. It wasn't pled on liability. And for that reason alone, the court ought not to reverse the judgment on that part. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keltner. Mr. Bickle.
Briefly, Your Honor, I would urge that even if you were to adopt the standard presented by Mr. Keltner, and you were to disregard Limestone, I would urge that really what you should do, if you believe you're inclined, if Limestone and the five factors are not outcome determinative in this case, I would urge that there are two things that St. Joseph talks about, two factors. Number one, was it a benefit to the hospital? Number two, did the hospital direct the details? I would urge that's basically the Limestone factors. That is the control that we're talking about. Limestone established control. Those factors we've talked about, and I could go through them again, but they're pronounced. And one thing I didn't hear Mr. Keltner talk about was the fact that during this incubation period, when he's this newly recruited physician, he has the proctor, and the hospital has a responsibility to Dr. Fuens as well as Dr. Fuens to the hospital in terms of this proctoring process. And I would urge that's the kind of control that is certainly in addition to all the other instances of control that we've talked about. And by the way, I would differ also with Mr. Keltner in terms of the importance of staff physicians have to serve on call. If that's all Dr. Fuens had to do in this agreement, that would be one thing, but it goes far beyond that. The control they exercise is far greater than just having to serve on call. It's true he can serve on call in other hospitals. He can have staff privileges at other hospitals, but he can't have the same kind of arrangement as he has at Harris Methodist. That is the written rule. And I would urge that you can read this agreement, and you can certainly say by reading the agreement that there are so many indicia of control, one of two things happen. Either it should be reversed and rendered, or alternatively, it should be remanded to the court and directing the court what to do in that regard, either by way of just reading the contract or applying also the evidence which is also before this court as well as the court below, and that is the actual control that was in place for outside of the agreement, which we also have. I would urge a couple other things that we talked about. David briefly mentioned the fact that Lee Farlow signed some forms. Yes, he did sign some forms, but he signed some forms, and the testimony was abundantly clear that he was retching with a headache. He literally was in a fetal position when taken to the hospital. No one is taking the position that he was of right mind, I would hope, that when he scratched his name to that form, that that should be sufficient in this case. So I would urge that hopefully is not the argument. The other issue is ratification. Ratification requires two things. Number one, that you benefit from it. Number two, that not only is there a benefit, but you know about, in this case, the negligence of the doctor. There was a finding, of course, of negligence. They did have a proceeding to look into Dr. Fewins and what happened in that proceeding. And once they did that, they still billed $280,000 to this family for what they did. So if that's not a ratification, I would urge that it's almost impossible under the law to secure that. In terms of the oral argument handout, I have not had a chance to read that. If it would please the court, if I see something that I just disagree with, and I'm not going to do it just to be nitpicky, but if so, I'd like the permission to submit a couple-page response to it, if possible. I didn't introduce my client. Mrs. Farlow is here with me, and I was remiss in that regard. I did want you to see her and her to see you. And she has been with us all the entire journey of this case. We've taken this case pro bono in terms of not only the fees but also the expenses because we believe in this case. We believe the harm that's been done has been so tragic to this family, and we would urge that this portion of the case be sent back for a proper finding in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bickle. Mr. Keltner, co-counsel, Ms. Farlow, the court appreciates all of you appearing here this morning. Arguments were well done, as well as the briefing, and very helpful. The case is submitted, and you all are excused. Thank you.